Welcome to the Word from Porter Street, the podcast in which I, Chris Phillips, report on my teaching, research, and whatever else might occur to me to talk about. For this installment from March 23rd, 2011, it's been over a month and a half since my last installment. There's been a lot going on. I've submitted a book manuscript, I've been on spring break, I've been to a fantastic conference, and a lot of other things I can't remember at the moment. I do remember it was 75 degrees at some point last week. Today we had snow, sleet, and rain. So spring is slow in arriving in Pennsylvania this year. This gives me the chance to take stock of what's been going on the last month and a half or so. This installment I'd like to focus on talking about the lecture I gave at Lehigh back in February. First of all, I'd like to thank Ed Whitley, who's the director of the American Studies program at Lehigh, for inviting me to come give a talk. And it was a great audience. I really enjoyed getting to share my research with them. This was the first talk that I'd given on the new research I've been doing over my research leave, focused on hymns and the way that people read these. And this particular lecture was focused on the ways that group identity has been shaped in American history by hymn books, the creation of hymn books, the consumption of hymn books. I began the talk by focusing on the role of hymn books in the education of slaves. When missionaries such as Samuel Davies, who was a New Light Presbyterian in the 1750s, came to Virginia and started teaching slaves the gospel, but also teaching them how to read the gospel, and he found that using Watts's hymns was one of the most effective ways of doing this. He sent away to London to ask his sponsors to supply him with books to give away to slaves as rewards for learning how to read. And he received a large shipment back and reported that the slaves were staying up all hours of the night singing in his house and waking him up with their singing. They were so excited to receive these books. But Davies' description shows that not only are these books being used for reading, they're also being used to lead worship services among African Americans. African Americans are leading their own worship services. And I argue that this actually became the beginning of African American religion in the United States, that the kind of literacy that was allowed by these hymn books allowed individuals to share their literacy with the entire community. Even people who could not read could participate in the hymn singing. And at the same time, these became a very important form of property, and they would be passed down from generation to generation until by the 1830s there were still eyewitness accounts of Virginia slaves who possessed hymn books that they could trace back from initial gifts from Samuel Davies. Later examples of this kind of creating community identity through hymn books extended to, for example, the Union Church of Africans in Wilmington, Delaware, a kind of offshoot Methodist group that was not officially part of the American Methodist Episcopal Church, but shared in many of the values and even overlapped some of the people who were involved. This group produced its own hymn book starting in 1822 and revised in edition in 1829, what I believe is the first instance, that 1829 edition, of Amazing Grace being included in an African-American hymn book. One of the really interesting things about the preface to this particular book is that in each edition, it describes the process of singing with the spirit and with the understanding, drawn from 1 Corinthians 14, this idea that you need to sing authentically and with your emotions, but you also need to know what it is you're singing. And the hymn books become a way of helping to ensure that that happens. And if this is done, the preface goes on to say, then the singing will help to create those who are not a people into the people of God. So that what actually creates the church, what creates the denomination, is not a polity, is not a constitution, is not a charter or a building. It is a hymn book and being able to share in the worship experience in a unified way through the vehicle of the hymn book. There's a similar motivation in the Church of Latter-day Saints very early on. And by 1835, the Mormons have created their own hymnal. One of the interesting things about this, though, is that it reflects as much where Mormons have been, individual Mormons have been, as where the church as a community is going, in the 1830s. There are about 90 hymns in the first collection. Only about 35 of them are by Mormons. The other ones are by Isaac Watts, by Charles Wesley, by Augustus Toplady, and a number of other influential evangelical and Anglican hymn writers. There are camp meeting songs included, a number of different traditions basically representing where the members of the LDS Church had come from as they had moved from Presbyterianism, Baptist churches, Methodist churches into this new Church of Zion. And this process of folding in the traditions of other churches into your own community was something that Catholics did with their hymnals. They included hymns by Isaac Watts. They included hymns by Charles Wesley as early as 1830 in American hymn books. And even traditions that did not draw on other hymns drew on the form of the hymns to produce their own tradition. An example of this that I was fascinated by in my research was the Congregation Beth Elohim in South Carolina, what became the first Reformed synagogue in the United States, and they produced their own hymnal in 1842. This was the first Jewish hymnal published in the United States in English, and it turns out that almost all of the hymns were written by one person, in fact, a woman named Penina Moishe. I'm looking forward to getting more into the history of the congregation, the history of these hymnals, and also find out more about Penina Moishe. It turns out that there is very little scholarship on these hymnals, why they were created, how they were used, and so I'm hoping I'll be able to reconstruct that as I continue with this research. The other project that I have going right now that I'd like to mention is that I'm gearing up for doing some summer reading for my Literature of the Sea course. I wanted to expand the reading list, which is generally from the American and British traditions, the ones I know the best, into international literatures, either written in English or translated into English for this course that I teach. And I have a list of about 12 different books at this point, ranging from books by Nobel winners, such as Gabriel Marcia Marquez, to Amitav Ghosh, who has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, to figures such as Yvette Christianse from South Africa that very few Americans or, in fact, British readers have encountered. So I'm excited to get into this list, but I'm also interested if anyone has any suggestions for something outside the U.S. or the U.K. that deals with the ocean. Please let me know. Either send me an email or post a comment to the website. And now, before I go on too long, I would like to finish this installment by reading a poem by a poet that I've been spending a great deal of time with lately as a translator, Seamus Heaney. I've been teaching his Beowulf translation, which I probably teach more than just about any other translation. I find that students tend to have a kind of glazed over look when they first start working on Beowulf. Oh, we're talking about the monsters again. This is just like an AP English. But as we get to think about why Heaney is translating this and how the different layers of the story, not just monsters, but political feuds, family squabbles, the need to establish your nation among rivals, all these things wind up giving the story much greater richness than just focusing on a Superman beating up on monsters would tell us. But rather than read from the Beowulf translation, I'd like to read from a poem that I've taught recently in the same course called The Haw-Lantern. This is from, it's the title poem from a collection from 1987 that Heaney did during some of the dark days of the history of Northern Ireland. And the image of the lantern that he puts forward here is from the myth of Diogenes, the famous cynic who went around in broad daylight with a lantern looking for one true man. And the haw is the red berry that grows on the hawthorn bush that appears in the winter when everything else seems to be dead. So this is something that is a common sight in Ireland and something that Heaney wanted to emphasize as a representation of the Irish will to endure, the Irish will to survive whatever oppression, whatever violence might be racking it at the time. The Haw Lantern. The wintry haw is burning out of season. crab of the thorn, a small light for small people, wanting no more from them, but that they keep the wick of self-respect from dying out, not having to blind them with illumination. But sometimes, when your breath plumes in the frost, it takes the roaming shape of Diogenes with his lantern, seeking one just man. So you end up scrutinized from behind the haw he holds up at eye level on its twig, and you flinch before its bonded pith and stone, its blood prick that you wish would test and clear you, its pecked at ripeness that scans you, then moves on. Well, that's all for this time. Next time I'll be talking about the Society of Early Americanists Conference. And until next time, may you find good words and delight in the words that find you.